Welcome to the Deeks.ai podcast, where Wake Forest innovators unpack the real-world magic of artificial intelligence through candid conversations. I'm Michael Ferrari.
I'm Ryan Scholl.
Please join us as we explore how artificial intelligence is transforming work across campus, one fascinating story at a time. Get ready to discover the human side of technological innovation. On this episode, we are joined by Dr. Thomas Brister, Professor of Politics and Foreign Affairs and International Man of Mystery. Please join us as we speak with Thomas about his personal journey with discovering and adopting artificial intelligence, how he's been implementing it in his classrooms, and where it may lead to in the future of education.
Konnichiwa, Dr. Brister. Would you prefer bonjour, hello, allo, ciao, namaste?
Ohayou gozaimasu.
As a polyglot, you've lived and taught all over the world. You're basically a true cosmopolitan.
Yeah, in some ways.
I've actually heard you referred to as the most interesting man in the world.
I don't know who that is.
So how the heck did you end up at Wake Forest?
Well, I finally had to get a job, you know. So I got offered here in 20 years.
You've had quite the career, and you're known as an international man of mystery. So do you consider yourself more of an Austin Powers or a James Bond?
Well, that's a good question. I actually teach a class this semester on James Bond. I think I'm more Jack Ryan, which is Tom Clancy.
So, absolutely. Great series.
I
like the books better.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen the Amazon show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's good.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you teach here?
Well, what I've ended up teaching a lot, I started out where I've taught before, focusing on global geopolitics, global politics, and came to Wake Forest in 2006. And a long time ago now, but the war on terrorism, the war on Al Qaeda, and all that was really. And I'd always wanted to teach about the terrorist issue. And so I started doing a course on terrorism. And then it's gradually evolved so that I've had to split off topics because it's so big. So I do mostly now international security type topics like irregular warfare and an intelligence class, intelligence and international politics. But I also still do my global geopolitics class and then international politics. So kind of along those lines, but focusing a lot on the security stuff more and more.
So Tom Clancy is your pseudonym.
Tom Clancy, yeah, I don't know. There's several of them out there. Several of them.
I'm sure you have some very interesting perspectives on how AI can be used in geopolitics. But I want to start with a topic we had briefly discussed before. You said you were an AI skeptic. And you're slowly coming around.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that journey.
I actually took a year off, year sabbatical, and I ended up studying a lot about AI, but also just how the digital world is changing geopolitics and many, many ways. And I don't think that the traditional field has really been keeping up with that. People are still thinking a lot in terms of, you know, pre-internet, pre-digital, and a lot of the theories and things like that. So. AI.
Was there a pre-internet world?
I know. I'm starting to wonder about that. But the year that I took off was 2023, fall to 2024. And when I left that spring of 2023, ChatGPT had just really emerged. And I didn't know much about it. A couple students would tell me about things. When I come back last fall, everybody is just up in arms about AI. All my colleagues, I'm getting emails. There's
surprise.
All this. So it's as I was researching it really is the fastest. What do you call it? It's had a faster saturation point than anything I've seen. I mean, I watched the internet from the start. It took 10, 15, 20 years. I would say every single day I'm trying to keep up with it. So I was a skeptic in the sense that. A lot of things I've studied about it have not really been so much education, but about what it could do to society, to politics, even to the way we relate to each other and things like that. But I finally broke down, and actually it was at the AI Fest last year that I saw this talk about something called Notebook. I don't know who did it.
I heard it was a great
It was a great one. And so I started playing around with it. I was a little skeptical. And I was, I would say, pleasantly surprised by it. I uploaded some things, and I found it fascinating. And so I just, you know, I started doing a dialogue with it. And I felt I could trust it a little bit more because it was the PDF files I'd uploaded. And then I started moving and just experimenting with Claude, and then with ChatGPT, and then Grok. And
Grok's always fun.
Yeah, Grok is different. So I'd say I guess I've been experimenting with it enough that a lot of the things that I am using it, just it's really for research and just for thinking about things. I'll just start doing a chat about something, and I didn't want this to happen because I wanted to be against it. But, you know, I was, you know, at first I said, I'm simply not going to use it. It's good. Just ignore it. And I was, I use it all the time now, just but for me, I use it for a very specialized thing, which is researching and thinking out loud. And I've absolutely learned things from doing this that I did not.
When you say you use it all the time, are you talking more in the professional sense or the personal sense or both?
A professional, mostly. It's really useful for me to, you know, fine tune my courses and keep up with things and, you know, having to double, you know, obviously double check everything. But I would say that was one thing. Now, the second thing that happened is I just honestly just started thinking it through. And I saw, you know, as I'm following it, it's just becoming widely used very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, like,
when you say what widely used, is that more in the industry or from some of your colleagues?
I think more in the professional world and, you know, the wider business world, more than in academia, I would say.
Yeah, I think from some of my research, I've seen academia is still researching, where the professional world is having to adapt.
Definitely.
And they are having to use it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it struck me, number one, just like with the internet, I realized...
Do you think that's here to stay, the internet?
Yeah, I think that's here to stay. But you know, whenever it first started, there were articles in the early 2000s about the internet was a passing fad. I really wasn't going to take off. You didn't have to have any. Anyway, so with AI, I started to realize, you know, they're 20, 21 years old, they're going out into the world. This is going to be around for the rest of our lives. And number one. And number two, I realized that it so increases productivity in certain types of tasks that if a person doesn't adapt it, they're simply not going to be able to compete with someone who does. It's just exactly. Not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's reality. Secondly, I realized that they're all using it because, you know, as we all know, like the kids use things faster,
yes.
Adapt faster. And so they're already using it and they're good at it and they know how to do these things. And so if they're already using it anyway, if it's going to be around forever, we need to find a way to adapt it to the academic world in some way, because it's not fair to them for them not to get certain, you know, ways of learning how to use it.
We've talked many times about how this parallels the spreadsheet or the calculator.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I remember when I was in elementary school, there was a big debate.
When you had to use the abacus?
Yeah, when we switched from Roman numerals. So I remember that very well. You know, people speculating. So then I thought that. So, okay. And now I'm honestly just at the beginning of this, but I am trying to now incorporate. And I don't know a lot about it. I really haven't looked into what other faculty are dealing with it. Now, what I did yesterday was my first thing is I made up a study guide for my test. Come on.
What did you use to do that? What tool?
I used ChatGPT. Well, no, I made the study guide myself. But then what I did is I said, okay, let's you know, bring up ChatGPT. Let's bring up Claude or whatever. And let's find some ways to take this study guide and use this to study for the test.
That's cool. Mm-hmm.
And so then I did it myself. I said, oh, I'm looking at this. So I typed in a query and I said, somebody give me a prompt. So somebody gave me a prompt. And then I said, okay, we just did this section. Let's do the prompt and then see if what we've just learned about this is accurate.
So you're doing this with your students?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so I just said, okay, we just did this certain theory. Now let's type in the guy's name and the theory and see what it comes up with and apply it to something. So we did scroll through it. And I said, do you all see any mistakes? Do you see anything that's not right? And we all realized that it was really pretty accurate. So I said, so then what we did
is... But that's an important point. And there, it's a theory known as the human in the loop, that you still have to check the output of these tools for accuracy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The human still needs to be involved.
But I will say I have even come to enjoy using it. And I never dreamed I would say this, ever. I never dreamed I would say this. But it has really been neat. I have actually, a couple of things, it has clarified things that have been a mystery to me. And these very obscure things that I've
studied. Of course.
But I just would, and so then what I tried to do with the students is that I said, now let's start to take all these things I'm giving you on this study guide and let's be creative. And so started to say, let's put some things together that may not seem, you know, that we may not have normally thought of having put together and ask it and see what it comes up. So I do think you can be creative. There is a certain creativity that can come. So I think like I'm going to try it again tomorrow. I've got some other ideas for another class. I'm going to do the same. Just take a class just to play with it, you know, mutually and give me props.
We've heard other professors talk about how they put their lesson plans or their syllabus or even some of their study guides into one of the tools to get feedback on where the gaps are or creative ways to, you know, educate the students on this certain topic. So it could be a thought partner as well. Yeah.
Oh, I think so. I mean, there's plenty of areas that I'm really concerned about AI, but mm-hmm. It's not so much the edge. But I think actually in the education field, it's got a lot of potential for being, and I think as it improves and gets better, it can adapt itself to each person. And it's going to be like a little tutor that you can have to work with. I still do, like you say, I still think we have to have a human in the loop. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that the job of professor is not going to be eliminated because of AI. I mean, I suspect there will be some, you know, job losses in the education field, but
Michael and I talk about this all the time, how we personally use it for learning. Yeah. We'll look up a topic, whether it's either a big topic or an obscure topic, whether it's something like, I know, electrical work or a topic. If I want to learn more, let's say about some topics that you know well, the Middle East conflicts, but I want to put it in terms I understand. I can actually say, put it in topics, you know, for me, that a fourth grader can understand, because that's about my level of comprehension. So it can explain it to me in that way.
Yeah.
Which is really useful, because if there's something you're interested in, you know, trying out or getting into, anything you can think of at all, it's nice to be able to have that, like he said, just like, break it down even more simple and make it seem less daunting. And I found myself trying things I've always wanted to try just because I was able to be like, okay, I think I can change the brakes and rotors on my truck. You know, can you give me a real simple breakdown of what I'll need and the steps to do it? And I did it. So, I mean,
I feel that's useful to that. I haven't even thought about that, using it for that. I actually keep it up all the time on one of my screens now, and I'll just be able to turn to it and then just have I like having conversations with it and then refining things. So,
Do you plan on giving your students any assignments using it?
Eventually. As I said, I finally gave up my resistance to it. And now I'm thinking now, and this is the more radical side, is I think that we're going to have to make some changes in our entire education system to deal with the dangers. To me, some of the dangers are that students are going to lose some skills. I am, part of my compromise here is they're going to come to class tomorrow with pen and paper, and they're going to have to, you know, write out what they've learned for the test. But that means
for some of our listeners, they have to describe a pen.
Oh yeah, pen. Okay, sorry about that. Or pencil, or yeah, or
you... that's something that has ink in it, and then you put it onto paper.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. I tell you, some students, I've asked students sometimes get out a piece of paper for a pop quiz, and I have to go find some paper because they don't have.
That would have been me.
Really? Okay.
I despise paper.
Okay, all right.
See, which in and of itself right there is like very interesting to like think about, because like when I was still in school, that's what I had. Notebooks, I had pens, pencils. And so it's even, I never would have guessed then, like, yeah, everyone will just have their own laptop in class. So it's like, even that little microcosm is like, now there's people who might be worried about AI, and then it's like, well, it can change so fast.
Yeah, it is changing fast, but I'm looking forward to it because, as I said, once you realize that we have to, it's we owe it to the students to help them to go out into a world that they're going to have to use it. So I think that we need to revamp a lot of things. It's going to take time. There's going to be a lot of resistance to it. There are a lot of problems with it. I'm not saying it's
Do you build any kind of AI policy into your syllabus?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the main thing is don't copy and paste and have it write your papers for you. But my idea yesterday was simply using it to study for a test. So I give them a list of terms. Let's say I give them questions to think about with the material, and they can have a dialogue about it. And I see nothing wrong with that, because they're going to come in and they're ideally, if they can find their pens, find some paper, they're going to write it out. And so they're going to have something in their brains when they come in. So I'm making them memorize things, because otherwise that's just something we need to do. So it's a matter of finding the weak points of AI, and then trying to create ways that you can not allow certain things to happen that I think are dangerous, where kids are not going to be learning stuff. They're going to become dependent on the machines.
Do you think working with students to kind of like work with AI with them and kind of, I guess, teach them useful ways to utilize AI would inherently cut back on maybe some quote unquote accidental cheating or what have you that can occur? Because depending on how you use AI to assist you, it might not be that different than using Microsoft Word and recommending a sentence change or something like that.
Right. I mean, I've been thinking about like, what is the line between cheating and between using it? Because we had the same thing with Google back in the olden days, whenever we,
had circa early 2000s.
Yeah. for writing a paper, I remember, not even having computer search on sources. You had to go out. And so this idea that you can get all of your, that idea for a long time that you had to have an actual physical book or physical piece of paper as one of your sources to make it legitimate. But the truth is that that's just one means of conveying the information. So just because it's digital doesn't mean that it doesn't, fit as a valid source. And so I think that's something that just psychologically people had to adjust to.
When you think about the writing process, because you said don't have the student write the entire, don't have the AI write the paper. But that writing process involves, a bunch of steps. You do your brainstorming, you do your outline, you do your draft, you do your revisions and your edits, and then your proofreading. At what point is it cheating for the students to use the AI? At what point is it, thinking of it as a partner?
I do not know if I can answer that question.
Okay.
That's actually what I'm going to have to
say. Yeah, that's a hard question.
I had my first set of essays. I do a first year seminar called Geopolitics of James Bach. So I had their first.
Can I take that?
Yes, you can take me. You can audit it.
I would love to take that one, actually.
I was a little wondering, what am I going to be getting? Now, it was obvious that several of the students actually did not use AI. So I was somewhat, relieved in a way. Okay, there's a funny sentence structure here, in this.
There's no AI I wrote that.
No AI on this. You get like 5 points for that.
You get extra points if your sentence is so bad that you did not use
it. Yeah, it actually made me feel better. But on the whole, I didn't really get the sense from the essays and the role, just from what they were. And part of it is I made them allude to sources from our book that we're using and from our class and things. And I don't know if you Obviously, I haven't used enough to know it's possible to get around that. But I was trying to make it more specific. Show me how you use sources in our class to write this essay. Yeah, so that's just, you know, as I said, I've just started on this, and I'll be interested to see what other people do with it. But I definitely plan to incorporate it from now on increasingly in classes, just because I think it's fair to them. It's unfair to them not to in some ways, because they have to go out into the world. And, you know, maybe there's going to be people that are going to be very adamant against it, and that might also be useful too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have some classes like that. But if everybody else is doing it and I'm not doing it, then I don't think we're taking full advantage of the opportunity. So that's what I'm hopeful about, is figuring that out. It's not going to be perfect. There's definitely going to be, but nothing's perfect.
What's interesting to me is talking to different people around the university, especially on the education side, is that policies can be very different from professor to professor, but also department, because engineering might be different than biology, which may be different than theater, which may be different than English literature, because of the way you use any of these tools as a partner or as an aid, because of the different kinds of work you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we've all heard about Google and deep research and AlphaFold to, you know, find all the stuff in your body and, you know, map the genome. And for scientific discovery, that's unbelievable. But then you come into a first year seminar and have to write an essay, and all of a sudden it's cheating. So the different disciplines, it can be very, you know, the usages and the viewpoints on it can be very different.
Yeah. And I don't fully really know how they use it. I mean, I was trying to get a sense yesterday, because I saw some snickers whenever I started doing it, and I had my, so, okay, yeah, we're going to do it. And I think that for some of them, they were a little surprised that I wasn't condemning it, which I think sometimes happened. I said, you know, let's see what we can do with this, and we'll do it in the class. And just to give them a sense that part of it is that because I'm now using it, I don't know that I can then say they can't use it, because I'm using it, and I'm using it. And so I think the way that you use it can be useful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I'll be interested to hear what other people have to say over the next while, you know. And I'm very aware of the critics of it. There's a lot of critics.
What are the critics say? What do you hear?
Well, I think the critics feel that AI eventually is going to really erode the intellectual capacity of students, because they're not going to actually learn a lot of material they need to know, because you certainly have to have data in your brain to analyze. So part of what I'm trying to do is make them, even when you memorize the data, but they have to get the data, they have to know that. And I'll make them accountable through a crash test where they have to memorize. But then on the other hand, if I pay attention to encouraging that, then you can see how, you know, we all have the advantage of having not had this, so that I can use it, and I've studied enough of my field that I can see sometimes where it's missing something or it's not right. I think the danger is they're not going to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Because they never have really gotten the basic knowledge. Yeah. So I think we just have to put an emphasis on basic knowledge. And my classes now, a lot of things I'm trying to do now is simply introduce them or review things to them that they just need to know. Mm-hmm. They just need to know these things. They need to have them in memory. And then when you just keep transmitting those, you know, some basic set, like in my field, basic set of knowledge about international politics or political science, then you're not going to neglect that, so that if they don't have that knowledge, they're not going to be able to really know what they don't know. Exactly. That's what I sometimes tell them, and you don't know what you don't know. And that's part of what education is to let you know there's things you don't know that you don't know.
Do you think some of the skepticism from the other professors could be due to AI literacy and their uncomfortableness or unfamiliarity with some of the tools?
It could be that, because before I actually used it, I didn't really know what it was. And after I've used it and seeing what it can do, I think differently about it because of that. I think that there's fears. It could be the fear of the unknown.
You've done a lot of self-study with it, as you said.
Yeah.
Do you think other educators especially would benefit from more literacy around it and more help in...
Yes.
Using the tools.
Yes. And I suspect there's going to be people who are never going to, they're not going to be open to it. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem here and there as part of academic freedom. I don't think that everyone's going to get on board for a long, long time. But I would say that for me, going to the AI, workshop, I learned a lot from that. And then I was able to go back and look into it. I even learned about things like there's a email called from Neuron. I forget what it's called.
It's called the Neuron.
The Neuron, yeah. And so you can start keeping up with things. And so then I've actually done.
I would highly recommend anybody who doesn't subscribe to that newsletter to do it.
Okay.
It's free.
Oh, yeah. And as I said, I eventually, when I get time again, I'm actually doing a talk on AI and national security coming up. I'm talking about AI in one of my classes on irregular warfare because the thing about AI is that it's not just education. It's I'm sure you've already heard this. It's more like electricity or the internal combustion engine. It's a general all-purpose technology. So it's going to affect everything.
So let's walk out of the classroom. Let's talk a little bit about, if you can maybe give us a preview of your talk on AI and national security.
Well, a lot of it is that, what we're seeing now in these wars in Ukraine and Gaza, and even very obscure war between Armenia and Azerbaijan a couple of years ago, is that, for example, Israel is using AI in their war against Hamas, probably more than any other state has ever used it. And there are some ethical dilemmas there. Part of it is that because of the modern high-tech battlefield, everything is so fast. Everything is so speeded up. You have to make decisions very quickly. It's very complicated. And so AI can help with that data management. The dilemma with AI is this idea of imagining that you could have weapons that are autonomous, that could make decisions. There is no human. And I think for the United States, the decision has been so far, no, we're always going to have a human in the loop.
Mm-hmm.
However, because this is international politics.
But we've all seen Matthew Broderick War Games from, 1987 or whatever year that was.
Shall we play a game?
I'm going to ask you that.
How about global thermonuclear war? Sorry.
All right.
Yeah. So, but, there is a lot going on now. Internationally, there's a lot of conflict, a great power conflict. And so I think that what we're seeing with AI is that China and Russia, for example, are both convinced that whoever dominates in AI is going to dominate militarily, dominate perhaps in many other ways. And we had the Manhattan Project for the atomic bomb. We just had one Manhattan Project. We have several Manhattan Projects going on all around the world. And so that's what makes this a lot more unpredictable. We're in the realm of chaos theory, complexity. And so would China or Russia be willing to go a step farther? Would they maybe see autonomous weapons as something they're willing to go that far with? Let's say we're not. Would they see that as possibly an advantage? So those are some things. And I think where this gets difficult is when you have these arms races or when you have situations where if you don't do what your adversaries are doing, you're going to fall behind.
The big AI labs now have asked this administration to take off the guardrails. Because they've both Google and I think OpenAI put out paper saying, if we don't allow our labs to do a little more, the race for AI is over. China will defeat us.
And that's what's really surprised me, because I think there's been this misconception about China that's really dated now, that Chinese can only steal. They're not creative with stuff. They're actually far more ahead with a lot of technology than we realize. That is a very dated view of China. Mm-hmm. And so they're ahead of many things. And so I agree. I don't know that much about this DeepSeek surprise that came out. I don't know how much of it.
That was more media hype than anything else.
That was my suspicion. But still, things like that are going to happen, I think, continuously. And so there's a destabilization there. So a lot of my concern with AI has more to do with the social order or with it. We all have our technology now, our communications technology. It actually disconnects us more than it connects us in some ways.
Completely.
Like it used to be, you know, like TV connected us more.
Mm-hmm.
But as we get more disconnected, my fear is that, especially with AI being able to really mold itself to us, or, you know, and those kind of things, that we could, you know, add on to that augmented reality, virtual reality.
Yeah.
And we can have people that we're all, in a way, losing contact with reality, if you want to put it like that.
I know some people have already lost contact with
it. Oh, you do? Okay. Yeah.
I think totally agree.
So I think in there, but okay, part of it here is that I think that we just have to, the more we're aware of these things, the more we can get countermeasures to them. So it's sometimes I think that people who are, you know, talk about the catastrophic scenario, actually, it's a good thing to have that. Because if people talk about the worst case scenarios, I think it can help us to start to make adjustments so that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Almost makes it it can make it a self-fulfilling prophecy or not. To be able to, you know, to imagine like these are the worst case scenarios. And then now that we see that we're more conscious, maybe we can take cover.
Do you have your thinking hat on?
I don't know. I have an AI.
How do you use these tools to understand different cultures, understand how different people think? If you want to talk about two nation states and their negotiations, you can say, act like Russia, act like Ukraine, act like Israel, act like Palestine. You know, tell me why Hamas is doing this. And you can act as a negotiator. You can understand somebody's perspective. Do you see that as a valuable tool in learning?
Oh, yeah. Because, in my intelligence class, in the intelligence world, they call this red teaming. It is vital. You have to be able to put your mind in the adversary. That means you can't really live in a bubble. Because the reason I find the field I do interesting is because the consequences in war are, you know, very, very dramatic. I mean, you could die and your country could be defeated. So you have to try to be someone in reality. And part of that is understanding that you have to always be second guessing your own thinking process. And so getting in the mind of the adversary is very important. So red teaming. So that's actually something that I always encourage in all my classes, is to try to see the logic behind someone else's worldview.
I would love to see you or somebody in your position use the AI with your students and build a profile of the adversary.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So you're negotiating with either with a world leader or maybe even a soldier on the other side. And you'd have to understand their perspective.
That's a great idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, really. Brilliant.
I have them every so often.
Yeah, okay.
That's
very interesting.
Yeah, my nephew is actually, he's pursuing a PhD in like political science and stuff. And I believe focusing on counterterrorism and stuff. And he toys around with AI a lot himself. So he's been doing a lot with, say like what you touched on, like world leaders, specifically say taking their speeches, comparing and contrasting that with how they're being portrayed and what meaning is being given to those speeches. And then also with their actions and seeing where like things kind of line up to kind of see like, all right, is what so-and-so is saying about person A, is that lining up with their actual actions? Or is this like you were touching on before, like conspiracy or, embellishment or something? And so I thought that was an interesting aspect of how he's been using AI.
That's actually a great idea you just gave me there, is also just to get students to be more forthcoming about how they use it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think what I've been trying to ask them about AI and just have conversations about how to use it, I've noticed that a lot of them seem hesitant. They seem to not want to talk about it. And I think that maybe they're a little nervous that it's going to maybe betray that I'm going to disapprove of what they're doing, or that we all have this, idea that there's a lot of cheating going on.
We have colleagues who don't want to admit they're using it because they don't want their supervisors finding out.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay. On the other hand, I think that actually is an interesting idea, is simply to for them to be creative in like a project like that, creating a project using AI. And again, this is where this is useful for me, because
you can create a custom GPT or a Gemini Gem. We can show you how to do this.
No, I'm because I do a class on terrorism and counterterrorism, and that's tomorrow's class is going to be doing the same thing with the review for their test.
Yeah,
using the AI. I might run that past them.
No, there you go.
See,
but I can give you
some credit. I better steal your idea.
Why AI steals ideas all the time?
Well, I guess I know. Well, that's the whole point is, you know, yeah, how do you, because we're not making money off this, really. So I'm certainly not. So, you know, and I do know there's so many, this is such a big field and there's so many directions you can go with it. And as I said, you know, and things like what it could do to our politics, where do people trust information, or does it create silos of conspiracy theory? Because I call it conspiratainment.
Yes. Exactly.
There is a huge world in this very specialized conspiracies that people get into. And they're very smart people. Sometimes, you know, I laughed at it at first, this flat earth conspiracy. It's real. Yeah. I had no idea that it
was real. The conspiracy or the earth?
No, the earth is flat.
There are people who seem very intelligent to me who truly believe. And so that would not have existed before, let's say, the internet and social media and the things that we have now.
And
it existed, but it would not have been so accessible.
Yeah, and the scary thing now is it doesn't take too much work relatively to be able to get a quote unquote like NASA video of them looking at a flat, you know, a flat earth, or all six shooters at the JFK assassination.
Right. And so I guess for me, my challenge is just to be, how are they adapting in a way I don't know? You know, I just don't know. I want to know more about what they're actually doing and that they don't hide it so much. And I do understand cheating happens. That's what I'm reading. I know that it happens, of course.
It's happened way before generative AI showed up.
But there's, you can pay money and you can have people write papers. You've had that for decades. And there's been, you know, cheating has been going on in different ways. And so, yeah, it's not perfect. And I'm not trying to be a cheerleader for it either. I'm just trying to be a realist about it. I think there's a cost to everything. We have a cost and a benefit. You're not going to get, you know, the one everyone always brings up is GPS. I remember very well, I was pretty good at remembering how to get places, and you had to be able to give directions.
Yeah.
When I came to Winston-Salem, I got a big map and just memorized the map. Yeah. I tried the other day just to do something without. I was up in DC somewhere and was a disaster.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we lose something, but we also gain something.
I'm in the same exact boat with GPS. I will freely admit how bad I am with directions.
Yeah, now.
I'll put it in, you know, just go around Winston-Salem sometimes.
Yes. Oh, because I'd like to know the exact perfect way to get somewhere. And then tell me.
Traffic.
Yeah.
Or with traffic. And things
like but that. It's a great analogy how you do lose something, but you gain. You know, it's the old, you take one step back, but you take two steps forward.
Well, this is, you know, it's all other field. In fact, I had an AI conversation about Marshall McLuhan, who you might have heard of, the media theorist from the 60s, who pretty prophetic in many ways. I mean, he has this famous phrase, the medium is the message, which is basically how technology changes our environment and then ultimately will change. So you can, you know, say bring in the car. When you bring in the car, you're going to change everything around the car, and you're going to be in a different world because of that. And so with everything you have, you get something, but you also have to sacrifice something. But we've been doing that for thousands of years. So, you know, we lost the horse in a sense. You know, that was one of the most important innovations in human history was domesticating the horse. It changed history. But we don't have that. But we have other things that we do. And so you're not going to be able to keep everything. So I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna about it or try to, I'm not denying that it may not work out for us. And there may be negative parts of AI in areas beyond what we're talking about today. Maybe, who knows? But I'm just trying to say that I see it as a realist. That I've just looked at the situation, looked at what's going on. And I think that the next step is simply, we got to find ways to make it work into the university and the education system. And it might open up things like, you know, what you just told me about with your friend's project that I'd never thought about before. Because I like, you know, doing simulations in this you know, intelligence class, and you can perhaps help with that.
I have a suspicion too that a lot of people who are opposed to AI, all it will take is like the one specific scenario to change their mind, you know, because I try to think about both sides a lot too, because I have my apprehensions, but I also really enjoy AI. But, you know, I see how we're using it and how professors are using it and everything. And so one thought I had is like, take someone very anti-AI and give them the option of two lawyers and say one of them is, you know, exactly the smart, you know, knows everything about the law you can imagine. And then the other guy is more of like the TV bumbling public defender type character. But if you look at their numbers and the more bumbling guy is utilizing AI and has, say, a better record than the other lawyer, like, which one would you go with? You know, so if you're looking at like, yeah, this guy's successful 90% of the time, this guy's successful 98% of the time, I think you're going with the odds. So,
and I think that's going to be what our students who are, they're going out into the world. You know, I think we all remember when we going out trying to get our first jobs, very competitive out there.
Yeah.
And I know students have, I think, too much stress, too much anxiety. And so anything you can do to really help alleviate that, then, because, you know, that's the world. And we have to prepare them for this world.
We need to be competitive.
You've lived all over the world. You've taught all over the world. Mm-hmm. We are sitting here in an American U.S. university. Mm-hmm. How can this crop of generative AI tools be a connector for different places around the world? You have firsthand experience being in many different cultures, many different spots in the world.
Well, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is that the language barrier is a little bit less because the translations are pretty good because, you know, I've studied some languages and just looking at the way it can make conversations that they're having in these other languages accessible to us, number one. But then also simply, if you know how to do it, go and try to find out what, let's say, the media system in Germany is talking about, whatever's going on with Ukraine or other things, because it is going to be different. But that's something, again, I really haven't thought through that well about how we could use it internationally for, I don't know, I would just say better understanding of different sides, because that ultimately, you know, the whole red teaming idea is very important for anything. And to the degree that we don't do that, even in this country, politically, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We just drift farther and farther apart. And then people start to not really realize what might be propaganda, you know, that they're buying into, and things like that. I'm going to take the summer to just continue this research on it, because
so many things are happening. And
like I said, we just don't know. We simply do not know.
You agree.
It's just going to happen. So,
well, thank you for sharing your perspective.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This is interesting. I actually learned a lot, so I appreciate it.
Well, that is our goal. As I told you before, we want to spread AI literacy, and we're doing it one person at a time. So you had a personal session.
All right. So I had, yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. The things I've done here have helped me a lot to learn about it. So,
awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Deeks.ai podcast, where Wake Forest innovators unpack the real-world magic of artificial intelligence through candid conversations. We hope you'll continue to join us as we explore how AI is transforming work across campus, one fascinating story at a time.